Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that's entering the terrible twos. My name is Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
So, in this episode, we're going to talk about a badly planned, expensive folly that should never have been enacted. I'm talking, of course, about Labour Live. No, sorry, I'm talking about Donald Trump's summit with Kim Jong-un. No, sorry, I'm not talking about that. I'm going to talk instead about Theresa May's Brexit policy. Or maybe, probably a combination of all of the above. Because it is now, Steve, it's 2 years since we started this podcast.
Oh, wow. Hasn't time flown by?
Well, it's a different universe, though, isn't it? Marie Leconte tweeted out this week saying that the Eastleigh by-election was 5 years ago. And it feels like that is a completely different universe with characters long since killed off.
Yeah, we really jumped the shark in this TV series that is reality, haven't we?
We really, really have. Well, we thought after the referendum, everything will return to normal, and all we could do is just laugh about how David Cameron would get really pink when he was angry at PMQs. And instead, everything's in a little bit of a mess, isn't it?
Just a touch. It is a bit... everything is a bit broken.
We are recording this on Thursday, which means we thought that all the stuff with the EU withdrawal bill would have got sorted because the government's original plan was to ram everything through on Tuesday because there's too much stuff going through Parliament at the moment. Then they decided to ram it through in 2 days instead. And now, as we record on Thursday, Theresa May has seemingly gone back on her promise about some sort of meaningful vote, and we're not really sure what the word meaningful means anymore.
Yeah, so essentially, listeners, if you weren't paying too close attention to the ins and outs of Parliament over the past couple of days, one, I don't blame you, but two, what you did miss was quite literal horse trading happening on the...
Horse trading?
Yes.
Were they trading horses?
Yes, quite literally, yes.
Have they tried that with Michel Barnier?
Not yet, although I do believe that is a part of Davis's Brexit negotiation strategy.
We could give him a fox.
I think they've already shot that.
Yeah.
But on the the floor of the House of Commons, you had the slightly unedifying sight of the Solicitor General for the government, Robert Buckland MP, having conversations and trying to negotiate a deal with Dominic Grieve and the other Tory party Remainer rebels, trying to get them to back the government's original kind of motion on Brexit, and which did not involve a quote unquote meaningful vote for Parliament over the negotiations. And instead, Dominic Grieve was putting forward a notion that, well, guess what? Parliament should have a meaningful vote, and that includes the ability to take control over negotiations. You know, things fall through. And government didn't like that, and so spent the entire time yesterday trying, and it seemed with great success, to buy off or at least get the rebels on board. As I say, this seemed to be successful. The rebellion was called off. Except today, the government appears, at least according to the rebels, to have reneged on their promises. And rebellion may be back on. Dominic Grieve is said to be unhappy. Anna Salisbury has been...
Never happy.
Is never happy, especially with this government. And was speaking quite directly to the media, exclaiming exactly how unhappy she is. Basically, the government seemed to have royally annoyed and pissed off the Remain rebels, and God knows what's going to happen over the next couple of days.
No, it was quite fun reading the journalists on Twitter talk about the deals that were happening in the House of Commons, on the floor of the House of Commons, while probably it was the SNP who were giving their speeches, because as they complain about, no one really listens to them. Whereas, of course, every true politico knows that backroom deals should only ever happen in smoke-filled rooms. And it should be cigar smoke.
Yes, preferably.
Because we are living in a 1920s Hollywood film. So we're not going to go into the ins and outs of the government amendments today. And that's not because we haven't bothered to read them, listeners. Not only with that, anyway. What instead we're going to talk about is what are the political factors that are going to affect the Brexit negotiations in Parliament and in the EU over the next 9 months. And then we're also going to talk about why, for the love of God, Remainers need to stop talking about a second referendum. I mean people's vote. Right, so let's talk about the government first, Steve. So you've already talked about how the chief whip, Julian Smith, has been trying to do deals with the Remainers, and the government seemingly seems to have reneged on those deals. And Anna Sadbury, you say, was talking about betrayal. I believe that it is now statutory that there must be at least one MP who goes on television every day of the Brexit process and talks about betrayal.
Yeah, that was actually a little known amendment that was passed by the Lords to the last Brexit bill that went through. It's just mandatory now.
I think it's one of the Henry VIII powers.
Yeah, almost certainly. Yeah.
And what that means now then is the first factor which is affecting the Brexit negotiations for the government is essentially that the government has destroyed and eroded any of the good faith with any of the parties that it was negotiating with, both in their own party, with their own backbenchers, but also with the EU as well.
Yeah, it is quite extraordinary how badly the government have managed to play their hand here. So there are a small, and they are a relatively small group, of committed pro-Europeans in the Tory party's ranks. Within their ranks, you do have some big beasts, quite literally in the form of Ken Clark and senior members of the party, such as Anna Sowerby, a former cabinet minister, Justine Greening, a former cabinet secretary, as well as Dominic Grieve, who has also served in cabinet as well, and David Cameron. So these are relatively senior and big names who are kind of acting as the ringleaders for this little rebellion.
It's basically all the cabinet ministers Theresa May sacked when she became Prime Minister.
Pretty much. You can almost guarantee that actually if George Osborne was still in Parliament, he'd probably be amongst them as well.
If George Osborne was in Parliament, he'd be Prime Minister by now. But that's an alternative timeline we don't want to go down.
But yeah, these rebels or saboteurs, as the tabloids like to refer to them, have, you know, they've been making a reasonable demand that, you know, Parliament should actually have some power in the Brexit negotiations. The government does not like this, and has just royally gone out their way to try and screw them over.
And it's interesting that the only time they've really rebelled against the government, I think I'm right in saying the only time they've rebelled and won anyway, is on that meaningful vote. And that the first was a vote on that in December, and the rebels prevailed. And I think you're right that they are a very different bunch of rebels to, say, the Maastricht rebels. And there, with the Maastricht rebels under John Major, it was very much a war of attrition and did seem very much designed to destroy the government. I think the difference is that this group of rebels does not want to bring down the government. Maybe one reason for that is, I think, a genuine fear that of a Corbyn government. And whereas with the Maastricht rebels, so you go back to 1923, the reason why Stanley Baldwin's called the snap election over free trade back then was because he was one of the few Tory leaders that wasn't afraid of a Labour government led by Ramsay MacDonald, whereas other Tory leaders of that time would have been. And the Maastricht rebels weren't that worried about bringing down John Major, because the alternative would have been a Labour government either led by John Smith or led by Tony Blair. And what could possibly go wrong with a Tony Blair government? Don't say Iraq, listeners. It was a rhetorical question. So what it always seems to me that the political calculation Theresa May makes is if you can either piss off the Remainers or the Brexiters, she'll piss off the Remainers. Mainly partly, as you say, there's less of them. But I think also she does have a fear that the Brexiters actually would bring down the government, would bring in that vote of no confidence. I don't know if that's true. But I think what's happened with the amendment and all this business over, well, we have this verbal agreement. Oh, no, we're not sure what the verbal agreement was. Oh, I don't know, maybe Gavin Williamson's tarantula's got it. What it means now is, essentially, there is no way that the Tory Remainers are going to trust the government to further their interests in any further votes. And there are big votes coming up. There's not just the EU withdrawal bill. The customs bill's coming up. Immigration bill's coming up. I mean, there's a lot of legislative kind of heft to shove through over the next 6 months.
Yeah, absolutely. And in some ways, actually, the government was in a pretty unwinnable position. I think it was David Alan Green, the legal journalist for the Financial Times, summarised the situation as actually a win-win position for the rebels, because if they succeed and the government honours the agreement, then ta-da, they've successfully influenced the government and achieved their aims. That's a win. If the government does not honour their agreement, as it appears to be the case, well, guess what? They no longer have to pay attention to anything the government says anymore because they've reneged on a deal. And they win, and they've got the freedom to just do what they like. And that's a win for them. Either way, the government loses.
And though those ranks do keep swelling, so you mentioned the former ministers like Justin Greening, they had another member this week, Philip Lee, is a justice minister, who resigned because he wanted to vote for the meaningful vote amendment. In the end, he ended up abstaining on it. A feature of the Brexit votes this week has been that there's been a lot of abstaining going on. And there's talk that maybe there could be the four or five ministers that might resign in a similar situation. So I think if this vote does end up being watered down, you could see more ministerial casualties as well.
Yeah, it is entirely possible. I mean, Philip Lee's resignation is one of those things which, you know, on the face of it, you go, who? Literally, nobody has heard of this gentleman, really, unless you are massively deep into, Westminster Kremlinology.
He's big in Bracknell, where his MP, Steve.
Yeah, I'm sure the Bracknellites love him. Lee's resignation was one of those moments which has the potential to be read when the history books are being written as influential. It's one of those things where, because of the sudden nature of it, it's entirely possible that his actions spurred on and hardened the line of some of the rebels. Having something like that happen very swiftly with no warning, threw a curveball straight at the government, and you know they did their best to bat it back, but it's not necessarily gone very well for them. So Mr. Lee has had a potentially quite a big impact on the outcome of this vote, despite no one knowing who he is.
Best comment I heard about Philip Lee's resignation was, I believe he was an anonymous minister or an anonymous Brexiter who said he's just a shit James Pennell, which is not a football chant you're going to be seeing at the World Cup anytime soon, I don't think, not even in Russian. So as well as destroying the bad faith of their own party, it won't surprise you to learn that a government that cannot even negotiate a Brexit settlement within its own party can't also negotiate a Brexit settlement with the EU. So a lot of the... I mean, most of Europe, I think, has just been sat a bit baffled and agog at what's been going on in Britain over the past couple of years or so. And it's like, well, you're not alone, mate, to be honest. But in December, the government agreed, and Theresa May agreed, the issue of the Irish backstop. And the idea is that there'd be, I believe, that the essentially there would be regulatory alignment and basically that Northern Ireland and Britain will be part of the single market and the customs union until a solution is found to the problem of what do you do about that land border Britain has with the EU. I think that's basically right. If I'm wrong, please just ignore it quietly. And that happened in December, and it was seen as a big success because it was seen as Theresa May managing to get the DUP back on side. And then the government spent the next 6 months since then essentially trying to water down the commitment they made to the EU. And Michel Barnier basically says, well, no, we've made this commitment. It cannot be time limited. What are you doing? We agreed this. What the hell are you going on about?
Yeah, absolutely. The government, in its desperate attempts to try and keep everybody happy, most notably in this instance, the Brexiteers, or the hardline Brexiteers, such as Jacob Rees-Mogg, Bill Cash, and that ilk amongst the parliamentary backbenchers, has again managed to get themselves twisted into a knot. In order to try and move things on and make some progress, they basically promised the EU that, yeah, if worse comes to worst, we're going to effectively stay in the customs union so that we can keep that border with Ireland open. Now they've realised, actually, that doesn't give them much room to manoeuvre and to keep Jacob Rees-Mogg happy. So they're trying to water it down and, well... Michel Barnier, as you say, is not very impressed with this, and they're putting their foot down and saying, no, you've agreed to this. This is what you're going to get. You can try and weasel your way out of it as best you can, but you have already agreed to this.
And we've had increasingly bizarre schemes being briefed, mostly to the Sun, about how to solve the issue of the Irish border without actually being part of the single market.
I think you'll find that Zeppelins are clearly the answer.
Right, so we've had Zeppelins, we've had like bloody burning airlift going on. We've had what else have we had? Technology, we'll just solve it with a capital T. My favourite one that was apparently one of David Davis that lasted all of half a news cycle was that there would be a 10-mile buffer zone on the border. Because nothing says smooth transition like a buffer zone. Nothing says peace, I don't think, like calling something a buffer zone.
I was going to say, you've got to think, was he being inspired by the DMZ in Korea or something? Because it does not sound very appealing. Don't worry, darling, I'm just going to work across the buffer zone.
Yeah, Irish buffer zone communities against a hard Brexit. But I think, but just as Theresa May, her particular skill is kicking the can down the road, I almost feel like the fact that she's even going back on what she said to the Tory rebels about the amendment is just to buy us some more time. God, a week, 2 weeks, anything, just to hope something turns up. That essentially, that's kind of David Davis's plan as well. Well, we'll just keep on talking and we'll find any sort of solution. We'll just maybe, if we push the Irish border 10 miles further into Northern Ireland, maybe then we can find a solution. And if not, maybe another 10 miles. And then if we keep moving it and moving it and moving it.
Eventually, David Davis is just going to turn around and say the easiest way for us to resolve this situation is for Northern Ireland to join the Republic.
That is essentially one problem. And it's a pretty big problem, let's face it, for the government. The other problem is that the red lines that Theresa May has set herself in various Florence speeches and Mansion House speeches about trying to be out of the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice, about being out of the single market, about being out of the customs union. Thank you, Nick Timothy, your final contribution to this country, you massive, massive tool. Basically, those red lines, they're not compatible with reality. They can't be fixed. You can't solve the Irish border with those red lines. You can't pass anything through Parliament with those red lines. And you can't solve the fissure in your party with those red lines.
Yeah, absolutely. Theresa May's, I think, desperation at the beginning to just be seen as being able to deliver on Brexit as someone who was campaigned for Remain, albeit somewhat reluctantly, I suspect, said her to almost, I suppose, go too far in the opposite direction. She's ruled out far too many options. Whilst desperately trying to claw and scratch her way to some form of progress on the negotiations, which once again has gotten her into a muddle and tied herself in knots over what can be achieved. In effect, what it looks like now is that the EU has successfully managed to bounce Britain into maintaining some form of customs union or customs regulatory alliance off the back of the agreement about the border between Northern and the Republic of Ireland. Because of that agreement, the EU has basically the ability to say, no, you agreed to this already. We're not moving forward until you honour this agreement, which means they've got us over a barrel.
I think, also, for all that it seems that Britain is portrayed as a very, very divided country since the referendum, I think actually there is a kind of a mushy political consensus between Labour and the Tories, which is that both parties want a free trade agreement. They want a bespoke deal. David Davis, I think, calls it Canada plus 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 or something. And, I mean, in theory, that almost maybe could work. But only if, and it's a very big if, you had a decade to negotiate it, I think. I mean, we've said before, I think Canada's took about 7 years. It took 6 months to ratify. Well, since Article 50 was triggered, there was only 2 years. And it does go back to the biggest mistake that was made was triggering Article 50 too early without any plans being made in place.
Again, that goes back to the fact that Theresa May was far too keen to demonstrate that she was, you know, able to be trusted on Brexit, because she knew that as a Remainer, that there were people going to be gunning from her from inside her own party from the get-go.
And I think a lot of people were quite scared at the civil service, as Michael Gove calls it, the blob mentality, that essentially if there was any delay in pursuing Brexit, then that would be seen as a civil service attempt to frustrate Brexit. And you still see that with Boris's, Johnson's leaked comments about how the Treasury is the heart of Remain. This idea that somehow civil servants are trying to frustrate the will of the people, in quotes, as opposed to being completely unable to deliver on what is being asked of them because the government isn't being coherent and is being really secretive. There's an interesting Institute for Government report out, which is saying the main problem, the main thing that's causing the Brexit paralysis is the secrecy in Whitehall and the chaos in Whitehall and the complete confusion as to what the government actually wants, which is why the cabinet has spent 2 months discussing two different customs arrangements, both of which the EU's already rejected as unworkable. And we're going to get to Labour's Brexit position in a minute, listeners, because we've got that wonderful nugget to get through. So they are two pretty massive problems for Theresa May as it stands. Other problem, I suppose, is that essentially she doesn't have the votes. The parliamentary arithmetic is such that she's already really compromised in that the DU, the only party that's propping up her majority is the DUP, who won't expect any special status for Northern Ireland, at least not on Brexit. When it's on abortion, absolutely fine, but ooh, can't have it on Brexit. And again, because she's not got a majority, because there are two big outriding groups of ideologically committed groups, there's nothing that can pass her party. There's nothing that can pass the Commons. Maybe the solution, Steve, is to call
an
election.
Don't say it. Do not say it. We are not calling an election. Not another one.
No, I couldn't cope, actually. I think I would weep.
Speaking about weeping, shall we move on to Labour?
Oh, shall we? Okay, what are the factors that are affecting Labour over the next 6 months in terms of the Brexit process? I suppose the main one, and if you're ever on Twitter and you see anyone with a hashtag FBPE, you'll know who the person is who's really enabling Brexit. And that, of course, is everyone's favourite granddad, Jeremy Corbyn. Now, I don't really buy this, really. Those of you who remember the podcasts before the election, well, remember that we've not always been Jeremy Corbyn's biggest fans.
I don't know what you're talking about. Clearly, the glorious leader has always been high in our estimations.
That's true. Steve, of course, has been to one of Seamus's re-education camps. And the reason why Jeremy Corbyn is enacting Brexit betrayal this week is because he did not whip Labour MPs to vote in order for Britain to stay in the EEA. That is a European Economic Area. Norway's part of it. It's basically the EU, but you get control over fishing.
That's actually a very succinct description of it, yeah.
So it sounds perfect, except for the fact that there was no way that the vote could have passed the Commons, I don't think, because there are enough Labour MPs who are opposed to the EEA amendment, like so John Speller, John Mann, Caroline Flint, who are all members of a kind of Labour first, socially conservative working class type, Northern MPs from Northern seats, they voted against it. Other people like Kate Hoey, quite Brexity Labour MPs, voted against it. And with those 15 who already rebelled, it's never really going to pass anyway. You've also got the fact, I think, that really, Jeremy's not really interested in the EU as such. And certainly isn't really interested in a single market in the EEA. And I think in an alternative universe where, say, Hillary Benn was Labour leader and Labour would be whipped to vote for the EEA, then probably, I imagine, Jeremy Corbyn would not have voted to be in the single market. I don't think John McDonnell would have done either. But I think that's very different to saying that somehow Jeremy is enabling Brexit, because I think the problem that a lot of the real kind of hardline pro-Remain people have, and it's a problem we'll talk about when we get to the second referendum, is it's so much more politically difficult just to say we're going to stop Brexit. I mean, Jeremy is right in that you have to accept the referendum result, whatever that means. You can't start talking about second referendums. And as we've said already, his position is quite similar to the government's. You need to have some sort of bespoke free trade deal. Or the problem, of course, in practice is that takes too long. Where I think Labour's being pushed to by Keir Starmer is he's pushing Jeremy and pushing Seamus and the rest of the shadow cabinet. He's essentially pushing Labour into a position where it's got good reasons to reject the final deal that Theresa May comes out of. But I think there is no way that Labour could out and out come out and say, no, we're stopping Brexit, it's not completely on.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just far too much, really. Labour's position when it comes to Brexit is very difficult. They have an odd situation where, despite the fact that most of their members were pro-EU and voted Remain and are still, you know, pro-EU, an awful lot of their constituencies voted to leave. Now, there's a bit of oversimplification happening in a number of these areas, where Caroline Flint, for instance, talks about how it's her duty to represent her constituency, and her constituency voted to leave, therefore she's voting to make sure that Britain does actually leave the EU, which is fine, but it's still quite possible in a number of constituencies that the bulk of Labour voters voted Remain. And while some of them almost certainly did vote to leave, most of Labour's voters still probably, just due to demographics and the way these things work out, are Remainers themselves. So you've got a very interesting dynamic between politicians trying to find a balancing act between their principles, what they stand for and what they believe in, and doing their jobs not just as representatives of people who voted for them, but as of their wider constituency as well. Because the notion that somehow if Labour were to turn around and, you know, completely scupper Brexit in some form, that they would get a beating at the ballot box is probably ludicrous. You know, would it cost them some seats? Probably. Would it cost them a significant number? I doubt it. You'd be looking at losing some of the marginals, and that's about it. At worst, it puts them back to where they were before the 2017 election, I would say.
It's not a very strong springboard to launch a programme for government, though.
No, it's not. But it's still not the end of the world, either. It's not a situation where the Lib Dems are going to come from behind and overtake you. It's not a situation where a new party can emerge and, you know, an Emmanuel Macron-type figure can come forward and springboard over you to become the opposition or the governing party. Labour is in a tricky position, but it's not in a dire position, which in many ways is why I think Jeremy's doing what he's doing. Granted, he himself probably doesn't care too much either way whether we remain in the customs union, whether we remain in the single market or not. Basically, the only thing he really cares about is, at this point, is probably getting into government with a view to being actually doing some of the more kind of radical policies, which some of them would have been barred under EU rules and regulations. Not all of them, but some of them would have been.
And I think when it comes to formulating a Brexit policy for Labour, and especially a Brexit policy in opposition, there's a few different strands to it, aren't there? So one of them is the party management thing, which we've kind of talked about with Starmer. One of them is that you can say that Labour's method of going about the negotiations will be different. So we've talked about how the Tories have used up a lot of the good faith of the EU and of their own party. And certainly I think it's very easy for Labour to say, well, if Labour was negotiating it, we would actually negotiate and then do what we said we'd do and not try and go back on it 6 months later. I think that's a very easy point to make. I think you can make the point that a Labour Brexit, for all that people say that a jobs first Brexit is vacuous, well, actually, it's not really that obvious. A government's position at the moment is focused on jobs and the economy. It's more focused on immigration.
Well, there's quite an interesting little distinction which has emerged on when it comes to Labour and the Tories kind of positioning on Brexit. I can't remember who it was that made this point online, but I think it's quite accurate. On paper, the position of both Labour and the Tories looks very, very similar. Both of them are, let's have our cake and eat it. Both of it are asking for unicorns and the moon on a stick. You know, I think for the most part, it's things that the EU and Michel Barnier are just going to scoff at and say, move on, lads, let's get serious. But there is a difference between the way things are being talked about. So for the Tories, the focus is very much still on that notion of national sovereignty, taking back control, making sure that the government, if not Parliament, has got the ability to run things and make decisions again. It's the core rhetoric around the single market and getting out of that because of immigration. It's the core rhetoric around the customs union with the notion of are we a rules taker or a rules maker. But on the Labour side of things, you have that, as you just mentioned, that, that discussion of, you know, a jobs first Brexit, the notion that the economy and people's livelihoods should be taken into account and be one of the main factors for how we look at things. Now, that is a very distinct position, actually, from the government, because what it opens up is the ability to say, this Brexit does not protect people's jobs, so we will not support it. This Brexit damages living conditions and living standards, so we will not support it. It gives them much more leeway to turn around and say, no, we don't like this.
Well, interestingly, Barry Gardner says that one of Starmer's tests is that the Brexiteer must have exactly the same benefits to the single market and what have you as we had before. Barry Gardner said that was bollocks in a leaked recording. And in a sense, he's right. But then it also says, well, I mean, I think the question then is, if we don't have the same benefits as before, then why would we leave?
Yeah.
And that's the position you can get to down the line, but you can't get to now. And I think that's the problem when people accuse Corbyn of betraying Brexit or what have you. I don't think they've realised that that's not a position that most people in Britain are in at the moment. I mean, there's an interesting article from Paul Cottrell, who I think is a Labour councillor in the north of England, I think in Yorkshire. And essentially, there are two kind of different moral stances you could try and make as Labour in a Brexit position. One of them is essentially the Owen Smith 2016 leadership campaign approach, in which you say, we're just going to lie in a ditch and oppose it and just throw it out. Or essentially you take a kind of a Brexit in name only approach, and essentially you leave the EU, but you join something like the EEA, or just essentially replicate all the institutions on the outside. And yes, you've left, but in actuality, would not a lot have changed. And I think Labour's trying to head to that position more than the government is. I think if Britain ends in that kind of Brexit in name only, a lot of Tories, a lot of the kind of Rees-Mogg types, would not be happy. I suspect a lot of Labour MPs would be happy with that.
More importantly, actually, there's been polling which shows that actually the majority of people in the country would support an EEA type of deal, where we are, you know, still close to the EU but not a member of the EU. Because ultimately, I think the only issue really which people would actually feel betrayal over, quote unquote, would be the issue of immigration and maintaining membership of the single market and freedom of movement.
And I think, and maybe this can lead us to talking about the people's vote and what have you, because there's polling out and everyone got very excited with those FBP hashtags that they have now, saying, look, it's the highest ever proportion of people say that Brexit is a bad idea. And I believe that 5% more people thought it was a bad idea than a good idea. And that's the highest it's been in 2 years, is 5%. And we are 1 year ago since Theresa May blew a 20-point lead, and we now think that 5% is some sort of incontrovertible will of the people that we can overturn in a second referendum. Sorry, I mean people's vote. It's a stupid idea. Really, really terrible.
Yeah, it is assuming Brexit being a bad idea or Brexit being badly dealt with or whatever does not necessarily mean you will end up in a situation where you will win that second vote should it somehow ever emerge. It won't. I'm quite happy to go out on a limb and say that we're not going to have a second vote on this. I just cannot see any situation where it happens currently. I've been wrong before and, you know, I'll happily admit to being wrong again, but at the moment I can't see any way that happens.
Yeah, so it's partly, I think, the fact that, as you say, although people say that Brexit's a bad idea, that doesn't necessarily mean that people don't think that Britain should leave the EU or that the vote should be respected. And everyone said 2 years ago that there would be a referendum and the result of that referendum would be respected.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like, there was a wonderful kind of video clip that was doing the rounds when Theresa May called the general election. I cannot remember the name of the lady, but it was an old Northern lady or something.
Was it Brenda?
Yes. Yeah, I think it was Brenda, whose reaction was basically recorded by some journalist or other. Going, oh God, not another one, when told that the general election was happening. Can you imagine people's reaction when a matter that they considered now closed, for the most part, was being reopened again? Something that we had a referendum on. Something that, even though it was technically FBPE people, non-binding, most people will view it as a meaningful vote.
But and
if that gets reopened, you just end up with an absolute mess.
On that hard-hitting note, we're going to end this podcast. We'll have another one out next week, probably about some other chaos that's going on or something or other. In the meantime, we've got a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. We've got a website, notenoughchampagne.com, and our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. I'm at Paperback Writer.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting, everyone.